Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Lightning lit the early evening sky. Rain poured down onto the flagstones of the old Roman road. Thunder cracked and rolled, drowning out the pounding of the horse's hooves on the pavement. The rider was soaked to the bone, his hat a soggy mess and his cloak weighed down with hours worth of pounding rain. He shivered in the late winter gloom, his thighs chafed and his hips aching from the effort of gripping the horse as it galloped down the road. There was no time to waste here in February of 1454. His leather saddlebags carried urgent diplomatic dispatches, vital information for the Duke of Milan, an experienced backstabber and ex-mercenary named Francesco Sforza. The dispatches would tell Sforza precisely what Cosimo de' Medici, the de facto ruler of Florence, intended to do. There was a possibility of peace, an end to decades of costly warfare between Florence, Milan, and Venice. But the endless double-dealing of Italian politics meant that only reliable information could make peace a reality. If the courier failed, if the information in his saddlebags proved to be wrong or out of date, this road could just as easily hear the footsteps of thousands of well-paid mercenary soldiers when spring began. Francesco Sforza, a man who could reputedly bend iron bars with his bare hands and who had made his life and fortune through double-dealing and triple crosses in war, was nobody's fool. Neither was Cosimo de' Medici. Nobody survived the labyrinth of Italian politics for as long as these two without talent and skill, and that meant choosing the right sources of information. There was no margin for error, not when poison, assassination, vicious rivals, and the machinations of other powers were always lurking around the corner. This was the world that produced the roots of modern diplomacy, tools of state finance, even the idea of republican politics, all of them bound up with the cultural flowering of the Renaissance. This was the laboratory from which Machiavelli drew his famous lessons on the appearance and reality of power politics. The soaked courier spurred on his exhausted and miserable horse. Milan lay just down the road, just a bit further. Francesco Sforza was waiting. So was the future of Italian politics, the crucible that forged much of what we take for granted about our own modern politics.
Hey, it's Patrick, and I've got some really exciting news. You can now listen to our entire back catalog completely ad-free, exclusively on Stitcher Premium. If you enjoyed our episodes on the Black Death, on chivalry, on peasants, that great interview we did with friend of the show Dan Jones on the Knights Templar, you can come back to that completely ad-free anytime you want. In addition to our archive, you can also listen to every new episode ad-free, as well as tons of other ad-free Wondery shows like Dirty John, Dr. Death, and American Innovations. Plus, with Stitcher Premium, you'll get access to hundreds of hours of original content, audio documentaries, and exclusive bonus episodes from some of your other favorite podcasts. You can sign up now for a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and using the promo code Wondery. Then, once you're signed up, just download the Stitcher app for iOS or Android and start listening. That's stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and promo code Wondery.
Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. Italy was the most complex and unique political landscape in the later Middle Ages. It was a patchwork of independent city-states, small lordships, urban communes, and territories controlled by the Pope. No great feudal overlord exercised control over the fractious lot of them. Enormous amounts of money flowed through Italy thanks to the activities of bankers and merchants, the densest concentration of wealth on the continent. The result of that combination of money and division was a fiendishly complicated political landscape. Its dynamics differed fundamentally from what was happening elsewhere in Europe. This was Machiavelli's laboratory, a backstabbing arena for power politics on every scale from the local to the international. In effect, the whole peninsula was a crucible that superheated the political players in the game and forged them into efficient states designed to win conflicts that could go on hot and cold for years or decades at a time. As a result of that, Renaissance Italy was the birthplace of much of the machinery of the modern state. Diplomacy, as we understand it, was born here. So was state finance. War became a professionalized art and science. The constant conflict that defined Italian politics demanded new tools to face those challenges. More than a year ago on Tides, we talked about the Renaissance as a cultural and social phenomenon, about the new humanist learning and the rediscovery of the classical past, about how that grew out of and fit into the unique world of Italy. This political crucible was the context in which humanistic learning flourished, in which patrons paid for incredible works of art and architecture. They're not separable. The patronage of art went hand in hand with the subtle domination of a city's politics, as in the case of the Medici. The art of rhetoric was a tool for political persuasion, where the fate of a city might turn on choosing the right phrase. Some of the most avid collectors and promoters of classical literature were condottieri, the mercenary generals who fought the incessant wars of the age. For the next two episodes, we're going to explore this unique environment. Today, we're going to do three things. First, we're going to examine the players in the game and what made Italy so special. Second, we're going to talk about the events of the later Middle Ages, an Italian Hundred Years' War and a long peace. And finally, we'll go over the political culture and innovations that shaped this world. Next week, we'll zero in on one aspect of late medieval Italy, the practice of war as carried out by the condottieri, the famous mercenaries who charged enormous sums of money for their invaluable services. Let's begin with Italy itself in the later Middle Ages, in the 14th and 15th centuries. That's when we'll be talking about today. What made it unique in comparison to the rest of Europe? We can point to three major factors. So, first, Italy was highly urbanized, especially in the center and north of the peninsula. Nowhere else in Europe had such an extreme concentration of cities and large towns. The Low Countries, including places like Bruges and Ghent and Antwerp, came closest in terms of population density, but it was a much smaller region. The Rhineland boasted urban outposts like Strasbourg and Cologne, and South Germany had quite a few cities, but the area wasn't nearly as dense and the cities weren't nearly as big. Outside those spots, Europe was mostly rural. On this front, Italy stood alone. It wasn't just the biggest cities like Venice, Milan, Florence, Rome, Genoa, and Naples that set Italy apart. It was also the dense network of smaller urban areas. By itself, Tuscany had Florence, Siena, Lucca, Pisa, and a profusion of smaller cities. Verona, Vicenza, and Padua were in close proximity to Venice. Milan had Pavia, Piacenza, Bergamo, and Brescia. In any other place in Europe, these smaller cities would have been key urban centers for an entire large region, like York in northern England or Bordeaux in Gascony. The fact that cities were so large and there were so many of them had huge effects on the economy, society, and politics of Italy. England's nobility was rural. So were the great lords of France and Spain and Germany. They lived on estates in the countryside, which provided their wealth and gave them territory to hand out to their underlings who could fight for them in times of war. That was the essence of a feudal political system. There were important urban elites, the patricians of the Rhineland cities, the merchants of London and Paris, and so on. And they played politics, sometimes key roles. But they didn't dominate political life. Not so in Italy. There, the elite was generally urban. After about 1200 or so, the wealthy merchants and the old rural nobility started to fuse into a new ruling class called the Popolo Grosso, literally the big people. They were based in cities, places like Florence and Milan and Venice, and they usually made their money from trade, banking, and manufacturing rather than landholding. Their outlook was fundamentally different. So was their base of power. Now, there was still an important rural nobility, and there was always political interplay between the countryside and the cities. We'll talk about that a lot in the context of condottieri next week. But the elites who mattered the most were based in cities, and big cities at that. They had a different concept of what counted as virtue, literally virtù, than the warrior nobility beyond the Alps. Here, virtue meant sober self-control and responsibility rather than raw physical courage. Their conception of power and government was a lot different, too. When the people who run politics think of themselves as merchant investors rather than chivalric lords, there are going to be some different dynamics. The second key difference about Italy grew out of the first. Its economy was different than most of the rest of Europe. Banking, manufacturing, and especially trade were all central to this economy, far more so than anywhere else. It's easy to go overboard with this. Agriculture was still the leading sector of the economy by orders of magnitude. But the sheer density of urban areas allowed for the concentration of vast amounts of money. Liquid capital flowed through Italy's cities in enormous quantities, enough to fund the warlike plans of English kings and Burgundian dukes and leave plenty left over for urban mansions and cathedrals and art and armies of scribes to copy down the Latin classics. This concentration of wealth had some serious consequences for Italian politics. It meant that cities like Venice or Florence could tap into resources drastically out of proportion to their actual size. After the Black Death, Venice had somewhere south of 100,000 people living in the city proper, but it fought the enormous Ottoman Empire, the population of millions, to a standstill for literally generations. When Milan and Florence went to war in the middle of the 15th century, their armies were comparable in size to the forces that England and France used in the Hundred Years' War at the same time. The states of Italy liked to fight each other. They had the resources to scale up those conflicts and carry them on for years at a time. Third, and finally, Italy was fractious. There were no fewer than 25 separate political units in Italy in 1454, ranging from a single small city and its immediate environs, like Correggio or Carpi in the north, to a full-scale kingdom like Naples, which covered most of southern Italy. We've talked before about just how bewildering Europe's political map was in the later Middle Ages, about the three-dimensional tapestry of overlapping claims to rights and authority. But Italy took that to a whole other level of complexity. Why? Because there was no overarching level of authority to turn to. There was no king who could serve as the ultimate arbiter of disputes. Italy had once been subject to the Holy Roman Emperor, but no emperor had succeeded in exercising much authority there since the 13th century. After the middle of the 14th century, any imperial influence on Italian politics was a local matter. It wasn't one of external control. The upshot here is that all across Europe in this period, long-standing conflicts about authority and jurisdiction were getting settled in the direction of the king. We've talked about this a lot on Tides. Royal authority was winning out over semi-independent cities and nobles and bishops. They were getting pulled further and further into the fabric of the kingdom as a whole. The map was getting simpler. But that wasn't happening in Italy, at least not in the same ways. There was political consolidation, but kings weren't the ones winning, at least not usually. It was voracious city-states, constituted on different bases of authority, that were dominating their smaller neighbors. No king was staring down at everybody, waiting to take ultimate control with claims to royal justice and a monopoly on force. These three things, cities, money, and a lack of overarching royal power, made Italy a dog-eat-dog world of realpolitik. Unstable political units, riven by internal rivalries and factions, vied with their rivals for territory and power in a never-ending series of wars. In the interim, breakneck diplomacy, spying, and persuasion both set up and tried to prevent the next round of armed conflict. It's a fascinating and unique corner of late medieval Europe. Before we settle in to talk about how this played out over a century and a half of conflict, let's meet the major players. We'll start in the south, with the state that probably had the most in common with the rest of Europe, the Kingdom of Naples. This was the single largest political unit in Italy, and it was kind of an anomaly when compared to the rest of the peninsula. This was true in a few different ways. So first, Naples was a kingdom. Unlike Venice or Milan or Florence, it had a king who belonged to a dynasty. On top of that, those kings came from a series of foreign dynasties. First the Angevins, a minor branch of the Capetian kings of France. Then the House of Anjou, another minor branch off of a French dynasty, this time the Valois. And finally, the Trastámaras of Aragon. This complicated dynastic heritage and the connected conflicts over who had the right to rule Naples was one of the major ways foreign political influence came into Italy throughout this period. We'll talk about this in detail a bit later. Second, Naples was much more rural than the rest of Italy. Naples itself was one of the peninsula's major cities and had a population of somewhere between 100 and 150,000 in the 15th century. But it didn't have the same kind of urban elite that defined its politics. Instead, it had the king, and it had a powerful noble class based in the countryside, the barons. Those barons were hard to control. The key task of Neapolitan kings was reigning in and winning over the nobility. In this sense, Naples had far more in common with France or Aragon or Castile than it did with northern Italy. For these two reasons, Naples was a bit different, but it was still a key player in Italian politics. Every major political development that affected Italy as a whole included Naples. So, moving north up the Italian peninsula, next comes Rome and the Papal States. In addition to being the spiritual leader of the Universal Church, the Pope was also a Renaissance prince who ruled over a collection of physical territories in central Italy. These extended from the city of Rome itself across the Apennines, the mountainous spine of Italy, to the Adriatic coast. This was a diverse collection of rural lordships and urban communes, each with their own complex internal dynamics and would-be rulers. A lot of the famous condottieri, the mercenary captains who provided the soldiers for Italy's interminable wars, actually came from the Papal States. They had their own territories, which they used as bases, and then they hired themselves out to other states on a contractual basis. On top of these local politics, the Pope overlaid his own administration, officials directly loyal to him. These were often members of his extended family. Nepotism was a way of life in Renaissance Italy, and nowhere more so than with the popes. The Papal States were a rich source of power and revenue for all the Pope's many illegitimate children, nephews, and cousins. In return, they provided some stability for papal rule. The Pope's dual role as universal prelate and regional ruler carried some contradictions and a lot of instability. Popes were generally elderly, and they died frequently, so there was a lot of turnover. Policies could change a great deal as alliances and goals shifted. And however Italians regarded the Pope as a spiritual leader, as a regional ruler, they had no more reverence for him than anybody else. In 1478, after an assassination plot in Florence in which Pope Sixtus IV was heavily involved, one Florentine writer called him, quote, a wicked man, an ass's prick. Popes were political players. They made and broke alliances and fought wars just like everybody else in Italy. From Rome, we move north to Florence, the jewel of Tuscany, home of the Medici, a profusion of ultra-rich bankers and traders, and the flowering of the Renaissance. Florence was effectively an oligarchy, ruled by a wealthy and powerful clique, but it proudly proclaimed its heritage as a republic in contrast to the quote-unquote tyrannies of individual rulers in its rival cities, especially Milan. No matter what its ideological leanings, Florence dominated the surrounding region. This was a mosaic of hundreds of small communities. Each of them had its own laws and statutes and mostly governed itself, but they ultimately answered to Florence. Any stride toward political independence in this sphere of influence was met with force. The Florentine state, which included cities like Pisa, Arezzo, and Volterra, belonged to Florence itself, and they meant to keep it that way. Over the course of the 15th century, Florence increasingly came under the rule of the Medici, but they didn't advertise that fact. In this sense, the city became exactly the kind of signoria, an urban lordship, that they had railed against for so long. No matter who was in charge, though, Florence had the resources and the inclination to be one of the core players in Italian politics. Heading north from Florence, we arrive on the great plain of the Po Valley and the region of Lombardy. The city of Milan dominated this region in the late Middle Ages, ruled by first the Visconti family and later the Sforzas. If Florence loudly claimed to be a republic, a venerable expression of rule by the people and for the people, then Milan was a tyranny. The Visconti family had come to power in the late 13th century and ruled as lords of the city and the immediate area for all of the 14th. They eventually got the title of dukes, not just lords, and they extended their rule over much of northern Italy. Milan itself was a massive center of trade and industry. It produced the finest weapons and armor in Europe and played a key role in commerce across the Alps. The region of Lombardy around it was fertile and agriculturally sophisticated, with a dense network of both large and small cities subject to Milan. The dynasties that ruled Milan were stocked with fascinating people. The Visconti produced a few of Renaissance Italy's most notorious figures. The brothers Galeazzo and Bernabo, who built a regional state around Milan. Gian Galeazzo, who poisoned his uncle and built a state stretching from the gates of Venice to the outskirts of Florence. And finally, Filippo Maria, a patient state builder and notoriously ugly man who passed the city to the mercenary kingpin Francesco Sforza. Sforza founded a new dynasty. By the 1470s, Milan lay at the center of a state that could stand toe-to-toe with practically any in Europe. Finally, heading east across the Po Valley toward the Adriatic, we reach glittering Venice, rising out of its marshy lagoon. Venice had been a maritime city for most of the Middle Ages. It was fundamentally oriented east, toward the rich markets of Constantinople and Alexandria. To this end, it controlled a network of overseas outposts designed to safeguard and exploit those major trade routes. It included Crete, cities along the Dalmatian coast across the Adriatic, and then islands in the Aegean. The wealth of the East passed through Venice on its way to the rest of Europe, and the Venetians took their cut as middlemen par excellence. Their political life was stable in comparison to places like Florence or Naples, with a tightly knit oligarchy of merchant nobles led by an elected ruler called the Doge. A sophisticated system of government and financing went along with that, and the Venetians could draw on shockingly large resources when they decided to or were forced to fight a war. Genoa was Venice's great rival for most of the period, another maritime city, but its opposite in every way. Located on the other side of Italy, unstable and divided into warring clans, with a weak state and essentially privatized overseas possessions. The two fought for centuries before Venice emerged as the winner. After 1400 or so, though, Venice increasingly turned its attention to mainland Italy. With shocking speed, it built a large territorial state across the Po Valley in northern Italy, stretching all the way from the borders of Croatia to the doorstep of Milan. In doing so, Venice wound itself tighter and tighter into the convoluted politics of Italy. Those states, Naples, the Papal States, Florence, Milan, and Venice, were the major players we'll be dealing with, but there were many, many more pieces on the board. I mentioned Genoa, which basically faded from the scene at the beginning of the 15th century. There was also Siena and Lucca in Tuscany, the Kingdom of Sicily in the far south, which was occasionally united with Naples, and then the Duchy of Savoy, wedged between Milan and France in the Alps. On top of that, there were a profusion of duchies and tiny republics and single-city lordships. These smaller pieces were caught in between the machinations of the great powers, and one by one, they fell away.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
The later Middle Ages were a pretty violent time across Europe. We're all familiar with the Hundred Years' War between England and France, which at various times also included the Low Countries, the Holy Roman Empire, and Castile, among others. At the same time, to borrow a phrase from the historian Guido Ruggiero, whose work I'm drawing on throughout this section, Italy had its own Hundred Years' War. This was a multifaceted series of conflicts between the states of central and northern Italy that lasted from about 1350 to 1454. It went on with only a few breaks for almost that entire period and provided the context in which the unique political culture and dynamics of Renaissance Italy developed. While the Hundred Years' War in Northern Europe was basically about dynasties and their claims to rule over kingdoms, the Italian Hundred Years' War was mostly a competition for territory and the control of markets between cities and the elites who ruled them. Alliances between the major powers shifted constantly. They brought in foreign allies at various points to tilt the balance of power in their favor. In the process, the rich got richer. Those major states I mentioned, particularly Venice, Florence, and Milan, gobbled up their smaller neighbors one by one. In 1300, there had been more than 80 independent city-states in Italy. By 1454, there were only 15 left, and that number shrank even further toward the end of the century.
The Italian Hundred Years' War is too complicated to give a blow-by-blow account, but we'll hit the high points and try to understand the underlying dynamics that produced a century of conflict. To start with, the Northern Hundred Years' War enabled the Italian one. It kept French kings and nobles and a succession of German emperors busy with their own concerns and thus out of Italy. The last Holy Roman Emperor to do much in Italy left in 1329. The next visit was a brief one, literally just for a coronation and without an army, in 1354. At the same time, the Northern Hundred Years' War produced huge numbers of soldiers who got demobilized during temporary truces north of the Alps. This provided a ready body of hired mercenaries who could further the ambitions of Italian states, at least those who could pay for their services. What we see in Italy in the years after 1350 is a bunch of aggressive, expansionistic little states that were free to pursue their ambitions. They had the resources to pay for those ambitions. There were soldiers around who could be incentivized, remember, these were rich states, to fight to achieve those ambitions. It was a perfect storm to produce generational warfare. With that said, the political stew that developed after 1350 wasn't a sharp break from earlier practices. Italy's cities had fought each other for a long time. They had often used hired mercenaries to do that. What changed was the scale and duration of those wars, and the resources the participants could bring to bear on the proceedings. The first of these major conflicts was between Venice and Genoa between 1350 and 1355. Even as the Black Death raged across Italy and pulled thousands of people into early graves, the two great maritime states of Italy fought a serious war for control of the seas. Now, wars between Venice and Genoa were nothing new. Depending on how you count them, they had fought at least three major conflicts before this, mostly over issues of trade in the Eastern Mediterranean. The war between 1350 and 1355 marked a turning point, though. It shifted the focus solely from the seas to Italy more generally. Looking for allies at a desperate low point, Genoa submitted to the rule of Milan, bringing the rising power of northern Italy into the fray. The tide turned against Venice, the entire Venetian fleet was captured, and the Doge of Venice was executed after an attempted coup d'etat. That's a whole other story. To make matters worse, the strategically vital Dalmatian coast, just across the Adriatic from Venice, fell to the Kingdom of Hungary shortly thereafter. This was not a great time for La Serenissima Repubblica, as Venice was known. This wasn't the last war between Venice and Genoa, but the next one would be. The two went back at it between 1378 and 1381 in a conflict known as the War of Chioggia. This one was fought to the very end, and it very nearly spelled the doom of Venice itself. This war began even more poorly than the last one had ended for Venice. A Genoese fleet completely blockaded the Adriatic, cutting off Venice from its overseas trade and supplies. The Kingdom of Hungary allied with Genoa, sending an army to besiege Venice itself. To make matters worse, the Lord of Padua joined the fray on the Genoese side, cutting off Venice from the Italian landward side as well. This meant that Venice was totally surrounded, protected only by the maze of marshy lagoons that surrounded the city. The Allies entered the lagoon itself and took the key port of Chioggia. For a minute, it looked like Venice was finished. But somehow, through incredible leadership, resilience, and more than a bit of good luck, Venice turned the tide. They sank ships to block the channels into the lagoon, turning the besiegers into the besieged. The Genoese fleet was destroyed off Chioggia, and the last attackers surrendered. The peace signed the next year didn't look great for Venice on paper, but the war marked the end of Genoa as a major maritime and Italian power. Venice, with its stable institutions, quickly recovered. At the same time as Venice and Genoa were duking it out, the papacy was looking to get back into the territorial game. Think back to our episodes from last year, and you'll recall that the popes were unceremoniously ejected from Rome and spent pretty much the whole 14th century ensconced in the city of Avignon in southern France. The Papal States mostly devolved into the control of local notables, like the Orsini and Colonna clans in Rome itself. But the popes never gave up on recovering their lost territory, which amounted to most of central Italy. To pay for this task, the popes collected crusade taxes from all over Christendom. They hired mercenaries. They sent papal legates to accomplish the task. One of them, a Spanish cardinal named Albornoz, mostly succeeded in rebuilding the Papal States in the 1350s and the 1360s. But at the cost of constant warfare and increasingly complex conflicts with the existing powers of Italy.
Milan was the first to oppose the expansion of papal power. An exasperated Pope Urban V even proclaimed a crusade against its ruler, a guy named Bernabo Visconti. That conflict went on into the middle of the 1370s, and it was immediately followed by a war between Florence and the papacy called the War of the Eight Saints. This was a vicious little conflict that included the famous English mercenary commander John Hawkwood, the spiritual interdict of the whole city of Florence, and a brutal sacking and massacre of the small city of Cesena. It looked like everything was going the papacy's way, at the cost of much blood and treasure. But soon after Pope Gregory XI finally made it to Rome and set up shop, he died in 1378. Two claimants vied for control of the papacy for the next 40 years, a state of affairs known as the Great Western Schism. The popes had other concerns, and the other states of Italy went back to their rivalries and wars. The prime mover of the next generation of conflicts was the ruler of Milan, a guy by the name of Gian Galeazzo Visconti. Actually, Gian Galeazzo didn't start out as the ruler of Milan. Gian Galeazzo's father had shared the rule of the region with his brother, Bernabo. Bernabo was quite the character. I mentioned a moment ago that he was excommunicated by the Pope and the target of a crusade. And when Gian Galeazzo's father died, everybody expected Bernabo to dominate his quiet and unassuming nephew. This was a reasonable assumption, given that Gian Galeazzo was only 27 years old and he was reputed to be a little bit slow. Unfortunately for Bernabo, that assessment of Gian Galeazzo was seriously mistaken. As it turned out, Gian Galeazzo had both big plans and the ability to carry them out. The first step of those plans was getting rid of Bernabo and taking the city of Milan itself. To do that, Gian Galeazzo reorganized the bureaucracy of his lands around the city of Pavia, which drastically raised his revenues. More importantly, he built a serious diplomatic operation, the very first of its kind in Western Europe. Gian Galeazzo bought an imperial title from the Holy Roman Emperor. Then he made alliances with the Swiss and French lords who controlled the Alpine passes around Milan. Florence and Venice both disliked Bernabo, who'd been an aggressive expansionist for decades. Gian Galeazzo cut deals with both of those cities. By 1385, Bernabo Visconti was totally isolated and surrounded by enemies. Gian Galeazzo had created that situation without tipping his hand in the slightest. In that year, 1385, Gian Galeazzo felt a sudden burst of religion. He announced that he was going to take a pilgrimage to his uncle's city of Milan. He camped outside and invited his uncle to come out and parley with him. A nice little family reunion, or so it seemed. But the second Bernabo stepped foot in Gian Galeazzo's camp, his nephew arrested him, then entered Milan as a welcome liberator. Conveniently, Bernabo died in prison soon afterward. He was probably helped along by a little poison from his cunning nephew. Gian Galeazzo now ruled Milan, Pavia, and a large chunk of Lombardy. The next several decades of Italian politics basically revolved around him and his ambitions, which weren't limited to what he already owned. Next up was the city of Verona, ruled by a signore, an urban lord, named Antonio della Scala. Della Scala had problems with his neighbor, the signore of Padua, a guy named Francesco da Carrara. Gian Galeazzo allied with Francesco to take out della Scala, then allied with Venice to take out Francesco. By 1388, both Verona and Padua, and most of rich, urbanized northern Italy, belonged to Gian Galeazzo. His next target was Bologna, which technically belonged to the Pope, but in the midst of the Great Schism, nobody was paying much attention to that. Except that was for Florence and Venice. These two major powers were watching Gian Galeazzo's expansion with increasing alarm, and they set about thwarting his rapid rise. Now, traditionally, this has been told as a story of the two republics, Florence and Venice, setting themselves up in opposition to the one-man tyranny of Gian Galeazzo in an ideological war for Italy's political soul. This framing says a lot about the political culture of Renaissance Italy, something we'll talk more about in a little while, but the reality has far more to do with hard-headed state interests. Gian Galeazzo's expansion threatened Venice's thriving trade in northern Italy. If he kept going, he could pose a real danger to the city itself. Remember, this was only a couple of decades after the War of Chioggia. Florence was itself expanding into the towns and cities of Tuscany. Gian Galeazzo's Milan was a rival for control in this rich and sought-after region. The result was a flurry of diplomatic activity and armed conflict. The Venetians managed to raise part of northern Italy and revolt against Gian Galeazzo, while the Florentines induced the French to invade Milan from the west while sending their own mercenary army north into Lombardy. Somehow, Gian Galeazzo overcame this seemingly impossible situation. He defeated the French in open battle and turned back the Florentines. He signed a peace with Florence in 1392, but this was just time to lick his wounds and reassess. A secret treaty with Venice isolated Florence from its most powerful ally, and clever diplomacy turned the cities of Tuscany against Florence as well. Bologna finally fell to Gian Galeazzo without a shot being fired. In 1402, Florence was completely isolated and alone. Gian Galeazzo was on his way to take the city with a powerful army. And then, quite suddenly, Gian Galeazzo died. All his plans for an Italian state and hegemony over the peninsula died with him. In the aftermath, his little empire split up into various pieces. Florence gobbled up the cities of Tuscany to create its own territorial state. Venice, tired of having its interests in northern Italy threatened, decided to get into the territorial game itself. Within a few years, Venice took over much of the eastern Po Valley for itself, creating a state called the Terraferma, dry land. By the middle of the century, Venice controlled the eastern half of northern Italy and most of the Adriatic coast from Venice itself all the way to Albania in the south. War between Florence and the Kingdom of Naples dominated the 1410s. The next major round of conflicts in northern Italy followed in the 1420s. Again, it was a member of the Visconti's of Milan who was responsible. Filippo Maria Visconti, the son of Gian Galeazzo. Filippo Maria Visconti was sickly in his childhood and not especially charismatic as an adult, but like his father, he was an exceptionally gifted political player. After his elder brother's convenient assassination, Filippo Maria set about rebuilding the power of Milan. He too used diplomacy to isolate his enemies and then picked them off one by one. Parma and Piacenza both fell to him, then Genoa, and he extended his reach toward Tuscany and the Romagna, the area of papal control on the Adriatic coast. Both Florence and Venice felt the threat rising. Starting in 1423 for Florence and 1425 for Venice, war followed. As in the previous generation, this was an expensive and exhausting conflict that went on for years. The armies grew larger and more costly, reaching 20,000 men in the 1430s. That was larger than the forces the English and the French were putting into the field in the Hundred Years' War at the same time, fought by states with much smaller populations. It's a sign of how rich Italy was and how effective its states' financial structures were that they could carry on wars on this scale for years at a time. The wars went on into the 1440s with only minor interruptions. Filippo Maria Visconti had no son to follow, and only one child, an illegitimate daughter named Bianca. During this endless round of conflict, Filippo Maria married Bianca to a man named Francesco Sforza. Francesco Sforza was a condottiere, a mercenary general, and maybe the finest one in Italy. He and Filippo Maria had a long and checkered history. Sforza had fought for him, then switched to Venice when they offered him a better deal, and finally went back to Milan in return for Bianca's hand and the rule of a couple cities. Even after this, Sforza switched sides yet again when Filippo Maria tried to double-cross him. He finally ended up back on his father-in-law's side at his death in 1447. Filippo Maria was the last of the Visconti, but even then the wars didn't end. Milan declared itself a republic and hired Sforza to defend it against Venice, which he did for a little while, before the Milanese Republic ran out of money and Sforza took it over as its duke. The Italian Hundred Years' War finally came to an end in 1454, with the Peace of Lodi. This was a three-way peace treaty between Florence, Milan, and Venice that more or less settled things to the satisfaction of all three parties. Venice and Milan divided northern Italy between them, and Florence got Tuscany to itself. A little later in 1454, all the major powers of Italy—Venice, Milan, Florence, the Papal States, and Naples— signed another treaty, which created an organization called the Italic League, or sometimes the Most Holy League. Where the Peace of Lodi had settled disputes about northern Italy, the Italic League both established a détente within Italy and created a barrier against foreign invasion, namely from the French. The Italic League was remarkably successful. For the next 40 years, up until 1494, there were no wars like those that had rocked the previous century. Now, it's not that conflicts completely disappeared. The popes were particularly aggressive within their fractious papal states, and Pope Sixtus IV went to war with Florence in 1478 in the aftermath of the Pazzi conspiracy. It took a ton of work to maintain the peace, especially from Lorenzo de' Medici, Lorenzo the Magnificent, who spent his entire life shoring up cracks in the Italic League. But nevertheless, it held, and Italy thrived through most of the second half of the 15th century. But it couldn't last forever. Lorenzo de' Medici died in 1492, the last great upholder of the Italic League. Powerful forces were gathering on the horizon that even a living Lorenzo might not have been able to outmaneuver. Over the summer of 1494, French soldiers began arriving in northern Italy. Lethal Swiss mercenaries with their long pikes and commitment to taking no prisoners poured into Genoa. So did huge siege cannon fit to batter down the walls of Italian cities. The King of France, Charles VIII, would soon join them on his way south to claim the crown of Naples. The Italian Wars were the next phase in European power politics, and they put an end to the political world of the Italian Renaissance. Over that century and a half, from roughly 1350 to 1494, Italy was its own little political sphere. That's not to say it was cut off from the rest of Europe. Far from it. We've seen the intrusions of the Avignon popes and their eventual reclamation of the Papal States. I mentioned the involvement of the French in that 1391 campaign against Milan. And the Kingdom of Naples was a constant site of foreign entanglements, as kings of Hungary and Aragon and French princes fought to claim its crown. Foreign soldiers were a regular feature in Italian armies, especially in the 14th century. But by and large, Italy had its own political culture, meaning the set of beliefs and assumptions and rules that defined the political game for those who played it. The culture of Renaissance Italy more broadly, the legacy this time and place bequeathed to the world that followed, grew directly out of this special political dynamic. Back at the beginning, I mentioned the major factors that set Italy apart from the rest of Europe. Cities, wealth, and the lack of a political overlord, a king who could act as the ultimate arbiter of internal conflict. The result was a simmering stew of tensions that was always at risk of boiling over, both within political units and between them. With a couple of notable exceptions, Italian states were as fractious and unstable internally as they were in their external relations. Political disagreement was baked into the DNA of Italian cities, as much a part of their makeup as contracts, trade, and public festivals. The precise form of internal conflict varied from place to place, but factionalism was constant. This was largely the legacy of the Holy Roman Empire in Italy. The history of that is way too long and complicated to get into fully, but suffice to say that emperors regularly tried to assert their rights over Italy during the 12th, 13th, and early 14th centuries. Their greatest opponents in this were the popes, ironically, given the whole holy thing, and the people and cities of Italy were caught in the middle. The result was that generations of Italians were forced to pick sides, emperor or pope, in these conflicts. Those who followed the emperor were called Ghibellines, and supporters of the pope were called Guelphs. These labels lasted for a very long time in Italian politics, way after the conflict between pope and emperor was a distant memory. Factionalism was a deeply rooted habit, and if you were picking sides, you might as well choose labels that had a long and venerable history. This is why you still hear about Guelphs and Ghibellines in the 15th century. Factions, whatever they were called, were a product of the basic divisions in Italian political culture. The popolo grosso, the political financial elites who ran things in the cities, were constantly on the brink of war with themselves. Class conflict between guildsmen and laborers and the elite added to the fermenting stew of instability. Violence in the streets was a regular occurrence, to the point where a lot of cities voluntarily submitted to an external lord to bring peace and order. There was a definite trend away from the republican, communal roots of most Italian cities and toward domination by an oligarchy or a single lord, a signore, over the course of the 14th century. Florence was a prime example, as its republican heritage eventually morphed into rule by aristocratic factions and then the dominance of the Medici. Venice was an exception to the general internal disorder that characterized most Italian cities. Its political system was highly stable and organized, with a closed aristocracy and an elected ruler, the Doge. There had been a more popular republican element to Venetian government, but it slowly declined over the course of the 13th century and was effectively dead by the 14th. The Venetian people lost their say in governance, but the flip side was much greater stability for the system as a whole. We need to spend a little bit of time on republicanism and communal life. There's a long-standing argument that medieval and Renaissance Italy was the birthplace of modern republicanism, where the popular elements of government were tried and tested, and liberty had a shot. Now, there's some truth to this. Cities did develop a form of self-government based around the commune, starting around the end of the 11th century. In a few places, Venice, Genoa, Florence, Lucca, and Siena, to name a few, this did turn into a kind of republican political system with elected officials and some measure of power in the hands of the popolo, the people, however that might have been defined. In most of Italy, though, communal government was replaced by the rule of an individual, a signore. The Visconti of Milan were the quintessential signori. This process was mostly complete by the beginning of the 14th century. In the places where republicanism hung on into the late 14th and 15th centuries, it remained a powerful ideological force, especially where it blended with the rising awareness of the Roman republican past. Florence and Venice were ground zero for this, particularly in the context of the wars with Gian Galeazzo Sforza and Milan at the end of the 14th century. Now, these were essentially territorial conflicts between an expansionist Florence and an expansionist Milan, with an expansionist Venice sitting to the east. But that wasn't necessarily how they were thought of or portrayed. The historian Guido Ruggiero points out that these long and punishing wars were fought not just with money and mercenaries, but also with ideas. Venice and Florence, quote, mobilized the intellectuals who staffed their bureaucracies and the cultural leaders of their cities to defend and legitimate their cause. It wasn't enough to be fighting for territory. They had to persuade both their citizens and a broader audience throughout Italy that their cause was just. How did you do that? Well, you made an argument about virtue and civic life. The prime example of this kind of argument comes from a guy named Coluccio Salutati, who was both chancellor of Florence and a dedicated student of the Roman past, one of the first great humanists. This made Salutati both a key political player in the conflicts with Visconti Milan and a conduit for the kind of classical learning that was the essence of the Renaissance. In Salutati, we see the fusion of these two strands, fractious politics and the past as weapon in the present. For Salutati, true civic virtue, a life of liberty and purpose, could only be found in a properly ordered republic, not in the tyranny of a signoria like Visconti Milan. The ideal that Salutati presented was one of active civic life and service to city and society. This was both the duty of a citizen and a reward, and it could only exist in a republican city like Florence. Under a tyrant like Gian Galeazzo Visconti, Salutati argued, true civic life was either non-existent or a meaningless fraud. To support his ideas, Salutati drew heavily on the classical past, especially the letters of Cicero, the first century BC Roman politician and writer. In Cicero, Salutati and his compatriots found an ideal portrait of the active man, the person who sacrificed to make a moral and meaningful life possible for his fellow citizens. In Salutati's capable and persuasive hands, this was potent stuff. Gian Galeazzo Visconti famously said that a letter from Salutati, a prolific correspondent, was worth 1,000 horsemen on campaign. That may have been an exaggeration, but it's also a marker of how seriously people took this stuff. This wasn't just a veneer of respectability on hard-headed power politics. The historian Fabrizio Ricciardelli puts it like this, quote, in the race for power, the written and spoken word played a crucially important role as a code of reference with which to identify or contest. There was power in words. There were real stakes to the ideological conflict between forms of government in Italy. Letters and public speeches had the power to affect the behavior of a persuadable audience. In that fight, there was a real sense that republican government meant using public power for the public good, in contrast to the tyranny of a Gian Galeazzo Visconti. This nascent idea of republicanism, with active citizens taking a key role in political life, had a long future as the germ of modern republican theory, including, not least, for the founding fathers of the United States. Now, with that said, there's more than a little irony in the fact that Florence was taking over territory and cities at the same time as Salutati was so loudly proclaiming republican virtue. The Florentines got around that by arguing that cities subjected to Florence could only pursue their own true freedom under Florence's protection. Salutati wrote that Florentines were defenders of justice and not looking for power for its own sake, that Florentine government was the best form of government for every city, and Florence was the custodian of liberty for the whole of Italy. The cities, communes, and rural communities that fell under Florence's sway during this period, unwillingly, mind you, might not have agreed with that assessment. Whatever its pretensions and ideological leanings, as powerful as they may have been, the Florentine state existed for the benefit of Florence. The letters of Salutati and this culture of information and persuasion helped form the roots of modern diplomacy. We've seen how complicated and frankly backstabbing this political world could be, and it created the need for a new kind of permanent diplomacy. Even during times of peace, as rare as those were, the threat of war was never far away. Only constant streams of information and regular communication between states could maintain safety and find an edge on an alert and dangerous rival. It's not surprising that we find the Visconti of Milan at the forefront of this new practice. Gian Galeazzo maintained resident agents all over the place, whom enemies referred to as, quote, the Duke's man here, or even, quote, the Duke's spy. They handled official communications and presumably fed him the information necessary to make his many wars and maneuverings possible. In response, the Florentines under Coluccio Salutati and the Venetians at the same time reorganized their own foreign embassies and chanceries, though they didn't yet employ their own permanent agents. The Milanese operation expanded under Filippo Maria Visconti, Gian Galeazzo's son, and stretched as far afield as the Holy Roman Empire in Germany. Milan's rivals were behind the times and didn't follow suit with permanent embassies until the middle of the 15th century. That last gasp of war before the Peace of Lodi and the formation of the Italic League in 1454 was the real impetus for the development of permanent diplomacy. The maneuvers involved between Francesco Sforza, Cosimo de' Medici, the popes, the Venetians, and the Neapolitans were so complex that constant diplomatic communication was required. Maintaining the peace that followed required even more consistent communication to avoid the recurrence of war, coordinate action against those who would breach the treaty. And they tried constantly. The peace between 1454 and 1494 was, to quote the historian Garrett Mattingly, one of, quote, unity of wary hostility, a unity of continuous tension. Resident ambassadors were key to sensing a coming war, getting that information to the right people at home, and figuring out a response to prevent all-out war. Nothing like this existed anywhere else in Europe. Charles the Bold, Duke of Burgundy, was an Italophile in many ways, but he should have paid more attention to diplomacy. In fact, the Duke of Milan told Charles in 1476, by way of warning about his aggression shortly before his death, that the Italians, quote, went in conflict with three people, tried to make peace with one, truce with another, war with the last, to attend easier to the rest of their businesses and achieve their purposes. Charles may have liked Italy, but his inability to comprehend that kind of diplomacy was what got him split in two with a halberd. In fact, it was Charles the Bold's great rival, King Louis XI of France, who paid closest attention to current Italian practice. Through the Milanese and the French, diplomacy as we understand it spread to the rest of Europe. It was just one more innovation that grew out of the hothouse of Italian politics in this period. As you might expect, war itself was transformed by this century of constant conflict. The states of Italy grew far more efficient in how they paid for it, reorganizing their bureaucracies and tax collection to fund round after round after round of war. Instead of citizen militias, professional mercenaries, condottieri, grew to dominate the practice of war. First foreign and then Italian-born commanders built what were effectively permanent armies, trained and disciplined forces that demanded top dollar for their services. Things that developed in Italy in this period became de rigueur for early modern Europe more generally in the coming centuries. We'll talk about the condottieri in great detail next week, but this bears repeating. The transformation of war grew out of the particular political climate of 14th and 15th century Italy. Italy was its own political world, and it was where much of what we take for granted about modern politics was born and grew to adolescence. The Italian Wars, the great conflict of the early 16th century, brought those developments to adulthood in Europe as a whole. Beyond that, we can't understand the Renaissance, its emphasis on classical antiquity and its art, its wealth and its ingenuity, without grasping the labyrinthine political world where it developed. They were directly connected to one another. The same people, like Coluccio Salutati, were part of both. Princes like Francesco Sforza patronized artists and humanist scholars and valued their skills as propagandists for their political goals. The line from the Renaissance to the modern world isn't as straight as a high school textbook might make it, but the path is there. Following it leads us here. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.